You're listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Lauren Reese, and today I'm speaking with Sarah Ladislaw, Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Climate and Energy at the National Security Council. Sarah has been a leader on energy policy, climate change, and foreign policy for more than two decades and has long been a go-to expert for decision makers grappling with their complex dynamics. In today's conversation, we discuss her recent address at the Munich Security Conference, the importance of climate finance and investments in adaptation, and the most pressing climate security challenges facing the United States today. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today. It's really nice to have this opportunity to connect with you and to hear about your work and your recent trip to the Munich Security Conference. Can you begin by telling us about your role at the National Security Council?
Yeah, thanks very much for the invitation to be here and for all the good work that you're doing on the topics that we care quite a bit about. So I'm the Senior Director for Climate and Energy at the National Security Council and Special Advisor to the President. The National Security Council is essentially the foreign and security policy coordinator for the President and the National Security Advisor. So as a practical matter, that means that in the various regions or functions that exist within the 300 or so people at the National Security Council, we try to coordinate across departments and agencies to ensure that the activities that we're undertaking are sort of strategically aligned and effectively implemented according to the President's policies and national security strategy. And so on climate and energy, which is clearly a huge portion of the both foreign and domestic policy of the United States, we spend a lot of time working with various departments and agencies on things like the clean energy transition and how we're deploying clean energy technology, things like climate diplomacy and how we're thinking about COP29 negotiations now and advancing the climate agenda. Things like climate security, adaptation, and resilience, which fall in the sort of boundaries of that as well. But we also do oil and gas supply security and energy reconstruction in Ukraine. So it's a broad portfolio. We also do a whole bunch of environmental security issues as well, but all in partnership with the departments and agencies that have, you know, the primary sort of authority for carrying out those activities.
Well, and this wasn't the first year that climate change came up as a topic of focus at the Munich Security Conference, but it was maybe more prominent than it's been in previous years. Can you share with us how you saw the issues related to climate change and climate security more specifically show up at this year's Munich Security Conference?
Yeah, it was a really interesting few days. Clearly, there's a lot of topics to be talking about in the world these days vis-a-vis security. I think this Munich Security Conference was sort of notable for a couple of reasons. One, it included lots of voices from beyond sort of the traditional NATO G7 kind of construct, transatlantic construct that the Munich Security Conference has had in the past, which I think was helpful in sort of broadening the dialogue a bit. And then two, you know, as you said, climate featured pretty prominently if you looked across a range of issues in a somewhat disaggregated format. So there were a lot of climate-focused dialogues throughout the conference, but I think one of the things that we've seen in lots of other places is, you know, if you sort of think about all the things that comprise the world of climate impacts, climate mitigation, across the board, there was just a huge amount of programming and conversation, and even outside the formally programmed climate sessions, discussion of the important role that climate and related issues have in shaping things like food security and water security and global health, but also critical minerals, clean energy transition, economic competitiveness, and trade. So it was a pretty strong through line, even where it wasn't sort of punctuated for a specific discussion.
And in your remarks at the conference, you stressed the need to deepen the integration of climate security into foreign and national security policymaking. So, I mean, we see how the issue comes up, right, sort of organically, because there's just a broader recognition of how climate change is shifting trends and sort of driving changes. But you also included a word of caution that the tendency for those in the climate security community to strive for comprehensiveness can, I'm going to paraphrase here, but cobble the ability of policymakers to actually make that integration happen in a meaningful way, right? That policymakers need clarity, prioritization, and a simple mental model for compartmentalizing various challenges and solutions. That's like a really tall order given the complexity of the issues. And there's like sort of an inherent tension there, right? And, you know, it's interesting because in many ways, the shape and the complexity of the challenges are changing, but the risks are still mediated through the same systems that they've been for decades, right? So like development assistance, targeting food and water security, poverty reduction, access to basic health services, humanitarian relief and infrastructure investments. But these are, I mean, frankly, we're still struggling to do these in sustainable and effective ways, right? It's still a sort of a steep learning curve. There's putting investments in what we know works can still be a challenge. So in your experience, what does or what should this sort of simplifying the narrative to really inform action, what can that look like? And are there any examples that you would point to?
Yeah, so it was funny to sort of make that comment and sort of choose that area of focus, because I think in the, you know, the lead up to, or in the front end of the conference or the speech that I made at the conference, I noted that, you know, climate change actually plays a huge role in U.S. foreign policy and in like the heart of our national security strategy. It features in sort of both of the core dimensions, the competitive, you know, the strategic competitiveness realm, and then the transnational sort of threats and need for cooperation realm, which was also a theme that was sort of echoed as a core tension in the Munich Security Conference. And so I think what I was trying to do in particular, and what we kind of observe is oftentimes necessary for policymaking audience, which is a lot of the folks that, you know, attend and participate in the Munich Security Conference, is to say, you know, our job is really to make the problems of the world solvable and accessible. And to a certain extent in the climate security community, sometimes because we want to talk about its importance as a threat multiplier, right? We talk about all the ways in which climate is like a vector into the things that people care about. And sometimes that can feel overwhelming. It can feel like in order to really get your arms around the importance of the issue, you have to talk about it in all of the ways that it manifests. And in a world where we're also very, you know, conscious of limited time and limited resources, competing attention and agenda items, that can be problematic for a really important issue like climate security to sort of cut through. And again, you know, when you go to a conference that is not necessarily focused on your particular set issue, and there's so many geopolitical fissures in the world today, I think it's important to make sure that we're putting a finer point on the ways in which policymakers, particularly in the national security realm, can access these issues and feel like there's something, a concrete agenda for them to grasp onto. And so I think that one of the, you know, one of the things that we wanted to sort of focus on is there's a huge sort of uptake in this idea on the clean energy side of the equation that we need to build resilience in supply chains. In order to do that, we have to work together in building complementary capacities, right? So if I'm going to build a lot of a certain type of, you know, equipment or a certain piece of the value chain of a certain kind of, you know, clean energy technology, I need countries in another place to be doing a complementary bit. And it's not a zero-sum competition. It is a way that we can work together to build capacity. And by building more of that capacity, we build sort of a, you know, a mutually assured resilience with each other. I think that is a helpful framework for thinking about climate security, where we can look at, say, for example, global food supply chains and say, hey, where do we need to be building extra capacity in our own individual countries, extra resilience, thinking about those linkages so that we are building that, you know, mutually assured resilience together. How do we think about regions of the world where, you know, it is probably more important from a U.S. perspective that we think about regional stability in, you know, Central America, as we're seeing so deeply in our own sort of politics and policy today, the impacts of, you know, Central America not being able to respond to a whole bunch of issues, including climate impacts, is really important for us to get our arms around the idea that our resilience in the United States is tied to those countries' resilience is something we're experiencing and will continue to experience as we, you know, continue to go through the impacts we know that are coming from a changing climate. That's probably different for different countries around the world. So it's really trying to think through, you know, how we can work in specific places where it's really important, those regional security dimensions are particularly important for particular countries. And then also thinking through how, you know, on just the sheer sort of like vulnerability side, really thinking through the effectiveness of the preparedness measures that we're taking in those countries. Not, you know, I think we have enough of the sort of early warning systems and adaptive capacity work going on in some places that really thinking through, you know, how we're measuring effectiveness along those lines. I think those are kind of key areas where if we divide into issues that have global resonance, issues that have regional resonance, and then issues that have sort of more of a vulnerability, fragility frame, we might do a better job thinking about which domain they live in our foreign and security policy, and help sort of compartmentalize the nature of the how the threats manifest for policymakers writ large. So really just wanted to have a conversation about some of the mental models that we as policymakers are bringing to the table as we grapple with these issues, and how we can try and prioritize and compartmentalize them in ways that might be helpful for drawing resources to them.
Yeah, and that point about mental models, I mean, that extends beyond just policymakers, right? It's also thinking about the private sector investments and what civil society can be doing. You know, USAID Administrator Power recently gave a speech on the end of climate shocks that emphasized the importance of investing in climate adaptation, including early warning systems and resource management, and the returns that these investments are expected to provide for investors, sort of preparedness pays, right? The sort of co-benefits that are yielded by investments in preparation, not just response, is an important aspect of this conversation. Could you talk a little bit about how you envision these kinds of investments contributing to global resilience? What does that conversation with the private sector look like, and the U.S. government's role in helping to sort of enable some of those broader investments in adaptation, and where you see, you know, those benefits coming forward in ways that really sort of attract those investments?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought up Administrator Power's really good remarks recently. Our colleagues at USAID and SPEC, the Special Envoy, Special Presidential Envoy for Climate's office, and others across the interagency have worked really hard in the context of the President's PREPARE initiative, which is sort of the adaptation initiative for and resilience initiative that the President launched towards the beginning of the term. And one of the things that I think has been really important that they've done over the last year or so is to launch a private sector call to action, which really mobilized the private sector to get involved in the adaptation space, and, you know, makes the point that, you know, we all know sort of academically, but we really need to change the way that we think about, you know, adaptation from being something that is a public sector investment, you know, as opposed to just quite frankly, you know, economies that prepare for the kinds of impacts we know are coming from increased climate change are the ones that are going to be competitive going forward because they've made that investment, right? And so I think that what we're trying to do, and I think this is a very important year for that, is really make it clear that, you know, the private sector has a huge role to play in sort of reaping the return on investment that countries can experience by investing in preparedness now rather than paying for the impacts later. And we're seeing this in multiple sectors of the economy, not just in, you know, one or two, but really across the board, whether it's agriculture, infrastructure, critical infrastructure investments. And so this year, you know, as we're leading up to COP29 and COP30, we're going to be, you know, there's a huge focus within the context of the G20 and the G7, UNFCCC, on really getting climate finance to scale. we think a huge portion of that conversation needs to be about changing the way that folks think about adaptation and recognizing that there are investments that the private sector can and should be involved in. They're part and parcel of having a competitive economy, and that their efforts really do pay dividends, both human and economic, down the line.
Those investments in adaptation are a big piece of the puzzle in terms of sort of shoring up the resilience of vulnerable countries to climate change, but those countries also play a big role on the mitigation side, right? And a lot of them are thinking about mineral producing countries that are really critical partners in the renewable energy transition and providing the materials needed for that transition. Could you comment on sort of how the U.S. government, obviously there's been a lot of really good efforts, right, with the Mineral Security Partnership and others in the sort of relevant spaces on developing partnerships with those countries in a way that provide benefits for those countries as well, right, to avoid sort of making the same mistakes that we've made in the past when it comes to extraction and ensuring that those efforts are also supporting the climate agendas of those countries. Can you just comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really important area, as we recognize that more and more critical minerals and materials are going to be needed for the clean energy transition. We're investing a huge amount here in the United States on developing those resources, but also working with countries around the world to do the same. I think our efforts focus on a few key things. One, really making sure, here in the United States, we're not perfect, right? We need to get all of the sort of mining and processing regulation, all of our own ESG standards, really continue to sort of evolve those, work with local communities, really make sure that we're doing the most that we can do to sort of advance the most environmentally friendly forms of mining and processing for these resources, but also, really investing a lot in recycling and thinking about alternative streams for being able to cultivate some of these resources, so it's not just a purely newly extractive enterprise. And I think that we've heard, a lot from other countries about wanting to do the same thing. And so we work with our partners at USAID and our development finance corporations and others to invest in those countries, to work with those countries on regulatory frameworks, to have ongoing conversations about, what we expect to see sort of developing in the market as well. I think that, it's really important to ensure that we're focusing not just on sort of the labor, environmental, and other standards that we all, care about, but also to the extent that countries really want to make sure that they're not simply part of the extractive part of a critical minerals process, but have additional value and economic capture in sort of all of the right social elements of the development that comes from those resource investments. We want to make sure that that happens as well. So it's really kind of a process where we're working with governments, with companies, to try and understand how to best achieve that. Also through things like, the President's Initiative, PGI, which is through the sort of G7 collaborative to try and make sure that we're investing in modern infrastructure around the world. I would say this is another sort of unique model where we're trying to not just think about, a particular, resource, but an entire corridor of enabling infrastructure that connects infrastructure and telecom and energy resources and in a way that is economically and durable and sustainable and high standards in many places around the world. So there's no one approach that we're taking to this, but I think there's an accumulation of different efforts that we're trying to, to work with various countries around the world on. But certainly a big area of focus for us and many of our partners and allies as well.
Well, it goes back to your point about integrating, right? This is what integration looks like, looking across the whole portfolio. So looking ahead, what's next for you and your colleagues at the NSC? You mentioned this year is a big year. Every year, I feel like every year gets bigger when it comes to climate change, right? The urgency grows, the action grows, right? Which is good. We want to see that. But what do you see as the most pressing sort of priorities and challenges for the U.S. in the coming year when it comes to addressing climate security?
Yeah, you very well said. Every year feels like a big year. I don't recall any recently that haven't felt big. But I do think this is an interesting year. Everyone, every year has sort of its unique challenges. And we spoke before earlier in the context of the Munich Security Conference. It's a pretty important time in terms of ours and the world, sort of foreign policy inflections. And so we have to recognize that we are trying to make progress on, you know, one of the greatest global challenges of our time, climate, in a time of you know, a lot of other competing interests and priorities from a foreign security policy perspective. So it makes for a very dynamic environment to be doing this work. I'd also, you know, point out we've got sort of half the world's population undergoing an election at some point this year. We've got, you know, continued sort of economic uncertainties and sort of, you know, post-pandemic sort of supply chain issues that we're still sort of working through, all of which are important when you think about what it takes to combat climate change, which is just a massive amount of investment in a new and, you know, clean energy system. And so, but all of that is sort of on the, you know, sort of the contextual category. I think for, you know, for us and for the administration, you know, we've probably taken on the biggest and boldest climate action the U.S. has ever taken on. And a lot of, you know, the previous year was about getting a lot of the Inflation Reduction Act funding spent and thinking about the regulatory environment that underpins that. We need to continue to make sure that that investment is effective in getting out the door. But then, quite frankly, from my perspective, that it starts to mobilize capital around the world connected to, you know, what's going on in the United States, that we continue to work with partners and allies who want to benefit from that, and that we really address some of these global finance challenges that I talked about before. We think it's a big opportunity this year to do that, including really, you know, turning the corner on adaptation finance so that we understand the true benefits of it as well. And then finally, I think that, you know, we thought that we had a very successful outcome, not complete, of COP29. I think we had a lot of really good signals about what we need to do to transition our posture on fossil energy, but also, you know, increase capacity for renewables and increase some of our ambition for the next round of nationally determined contributions. And so really wanting to make sure that this year we capitalize on all the really important forward progress that we've experienced both domestically and internationally to ensure that we, you know, that we continue the kind of investment and activity we've seen over the last couple of years in the clean energy, you know, space, the deforestation, you know, mitigation space, the adaptation space. We think we're headed in the right direction, just not quite fast enough. And so we want to keep pushing on all of those really important issues.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for the conversation today. And thank you for your leadership. It's really helpful to hear from you on what some of these priorities are and what the activities look like in terms of pushing them forward, and really appreciate your leadership and that of your team. So thank you very much for your time, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk again soon.
Great. Thanks for the opportunity.
You've been listening to the New Security Broadcast at the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information about the Environmental Change and Security Program, follow us on X at New Security Beat, on LinkedIn at Wilson Center Environmental Change and Security Program, and visit newsecuritybeat.org.